Welcome to BAM's new podcast, Beyond Antigone. The Brooklyn Academy of Music is among the most renowned performing arts centers in the world. Over its 150-year history, it has brought groundbreaking voices to the stage, from theater to music, dance to radio, and beyond. In this exciting new podcast, we invite you to take an intimate peek into the minds of the extraordinary artists that define BAM. My name is Tani Katenjian, host of Beyond Antigone. And here I speak with acclaimed poet and translator Anne Carson, whose translation of Sophocles' Antigone will be performed at the BAM Harvey Theater as part of the 2015 Next Wave Festival, featuring Juliette Binoche and directed by Ivo van Hove. Carson has been engaged with Greek writing since her high school days. She published a prior translation of Antigone, which she titled Antigonic, before tackling this one. In the first part of Beyond Antigone, we hear her introduction to the play. Later, I interview her as she reflects on her first translation, discussing aspects of the play that resonate with her, and what it was like to be asked to translate a work for the second time. Stay tuned.
On my computer, everything I come up with to think or say about this play goes into a file called Pile of Antigone, partly a pun because pile is a synonym for pyre, that is, funeral pyre, that is what Antigone is trying to transact for her brother, but also pile to imply a degree of resignation towards the sheer mass of thoughts, moods, theories, and contradictions that this play engenders in the mind of any reader or viewer. It is a text that does not finish with you, nor you with it. Somewhere in a letter, Kafka says, "We are in a holding pattern around the truth." It is a play that shakes itself apart when you look at it. The categories move or change, the definitions fail, the people end up in the wrong place. Antigone is always in the wrong place. "I'm a strange new kind of in-between thing, aren't I?" she says of herself just before her final exit. This strange question that is not a question evokes the entire monstrously mixed-up sexual history of her family, yet it also has profound political implications. For in-between thing, Antigone uses the Greek word metoikos, a technical political term in 5th century Greek, for a person permitted to live in the city of Athens, although lacking Athenian citizenship. Resident alien, we would say nowadays. But Antigone is not using the term technically. She means it as a metaphor for her own weird relegation by Creon to a place underground that is exactly like a tomb, except she is not dead. She will be stranded there in what Hannah Arendt calls bare life, or what Judith Butler calls a permanent elsewhere, which turns out to be a state of life worse than death. When Creon sentences her to this non-location, to this living death, to this in-between condition neither sacred nor profane, neither legal nor illegal, neither criminal nor redeemable, he invents the concentration camp. It is a region where the force of law without law can exercise its power. It is an action that rids the tyrant of his enemy but does not contaminate him with her killing. It is a state of exception that marks the limit of moral sense by making nonsense of moral sense. We are familiar with this nonsense today under the name of Guantanamo. But I'm a translator, not a political analyst, so let's look at a particular issue of translation that arises at several places in the text and which might give us a better understanding of the interaction between the two main characters, Antigone and Creon. It is a question of hygiene. The ancient Greeks did not like mixture. They thought it unhygienic. Dirt, in the ancient definition, is matter out of place. The poached egg on your plate at breakfast is not dirt. The poached egg on the floor of the British Museum is dirt. Dirt is matter that has crossed a boundary it ought not to have crossed. Dirt confounds categories and mixes up form. Its name in Greek is miasma, whose basic sense is defilement or impairment of the integrity of a thing. Throughout the play, Creon makes clear his preference for unimpaired integrities, pure categories. He talks in terms of friend-enemy, patriot-traitor, winner-loser, good-bad, us-them. The final scene of the play forces him to recognize the confusion and intermingling of all these categories, to see his own boundaries penetrated by everything bad. His recognition is expressed in the language of dirt. As he holds his son's dead body in his arms, he asks, "O filth of death, who can clean you out?" And a few lines later, standing over the body of his wife, he says, "Now I am perfectly blended with pain." It is Aristotle's dictum that a tragic plot is most effective when the recognition and the reversal happen at one blow. Certainly that happens here. But let us probe a little deeper into the effectiveness of Creon's recognition, which is also a reversal. The word he uses at line 1311 for perfectly blended with pain is a compound of the basic verb to mix and the prefix sun, S-U-N, meaning with. This verb is meant to remind us of all the horrific comminglings that made the House of Oedipus famous, and of which Antigone is a product. But more importantly, it reminds us that Antigone herself was the champion of withness from the beginning of the play until her death. Her defiant announcement to Creon, "I am someone born to share in love, not hatred," contains two verbs that begin with this same prefix, the withness prefix, sun ekthein, to hate with, and sun philein, to love with. Withness is Antigone's morality, Antigone's desire, Antigone's disaster. She begins the play yearning to join her brother in the grave. She says, "One day we will lie together in the grave, he and I, side by side." And her final lament brings her to a tragic recognition, which is also a reversal, in that passage we considered earlier. "I'm a strange new kind of in-between thing, aren't I? Not at home with the living nor with the dead." This may be the crux of Antigone's understanding of herself, that withness, reversed, is nowhere. Translation cannot convey the complex interactions of this metaphorical system or the inevitability of the catastrophe to which it leads. Antigone and Creon stand opposed to one another, instinctually, in the very morphology of their language, in the very grain of the way they think and speak. Sophocles' tragedy has this quality of tidiness that can be terrifying. He tucks in every stray thread. Or rather, he makes it seem that each of these threads was already woven into the same net. Why did anyone ever think they could escape? The end.
That was Anne Carson's introduction to Sophocles' Antigone. After her reading, we explored her experiences with the play.
That was beautiful. Thank you so much. I looked up Antigone on, you know, online, obviously. And you go to Wikipedia and it says, well, these are the main themes. And I thought that's such a general term because someone else, like for someone like you who is so intimate with the work, would see maybe a completely different list of themes.
Yes, or you'd see them as interesting because of the way they're interlaced, not because of the way they're, you know, separated out as a list. That's what I was saying at the end, just about that metaphor of withness, that it's something that runs through the play and in different bits of the language, and it isn't exactly, you know, one simple lesson about life that you derive from that. It's this complex inevitable pattern that people just slide into without meaning to be destroyed by it.
Much like life, I suppose.
I guess, yeah, it is how things just go on and kind of snarl around you. It's not ever so clear as in a summary of themes.
I imagine that must have made it quite interesting to translate because of that non-linear may not be the right term, but the fact that it's not about a list, but it's about the way these things intertwine.
Yes, exactly. And that's all the more true in Sophocles' way of using language, because he's a deeply metaphorical thinker. So to him, the various concepts of the play are one interlaced system that can come out in the nuances of different words. And once those words are translated into another language, the nuances are not necessarily clear because we don't use the same connections between those words. So it gets very difficult to convey in translation.
So I wanted to just talk about translation. I've done a bit of translation. This was a long time ago when I was in college, but it was French poetry, Blaise Cendrars mm-hmm. and René Char. But when I was...
They're hard. Pretty hard.
I can promise you I did not do very well. It's challenging to feel like you've done a good job because, you know, on the one hand, you want to stay true to the author, but you inevitably change the text and you tap into something more, well, contemporary, as we were talking about earlier, but also something within yourself. And I wondered, while you were translating Antigone, what parts of yourself as a writer and as a thinker did you kind of have to get into?
I think for me it wasn't so much the content of the play, because actually it was an assignment. I translated it because a director wanted to produce a version of Antigone. So I did it as a commission, and I address myself more to the way Sophocles uses grammar and syntax and words, which is what's unusual about him. And I honestly didn't think through the meaning of the play. I think actually, in translating, it's better not to, at least at first. It's better to stay on the level of the mechanics and make the surface work, and then go inside it and see if you've also captured the inner machinery. I don't know why, but that's my instinct, that if I didn't think firstly about the grammar and the syntax, I would be lost. But I've always been very fond of grammar and syntax in themselves. It's just a nerd thing. Before there were nerds, there was grammar.
Well, it's what's lovely about grammar and syntax, it just deepens language, and it's this other, it really adds so much to language. It can make it so much richer, because sometimes it's so hard to put what you think or what you feel or into words, just plain words. So grammar and syntax give you this other opportunity to do that.
And it is what, I mean, the grammar of languages is what makes them different from one another and essentially untranslatable into one another. So it's the edge where the greatest challenge is. But you can look up actual words in a lexicon and find rough equivalents as far as the content goes, but for the way the words work together as a machinery, that's something that's unique to each language. And you have to not exactly replicate it, but make something equally exciting happen in your own language.
So you must have been so intrigued by that initial translation that it inspired you to follow up by creating Antigone.
No, I did Antigone first and Antigone second. So Antigone, which is originally, it was a comic book. I wanted to make a comic book of Antigone. So I did a bunch of drawings and then realized that if I wanted to actually make a comic book of Antigone, I'd have to do about 5,000 drawings. And I flagged at that prospect and so enlisted Bianca Stone to make some drawings. And then I went back to what is my sort of province. I went back to translating the words. And I made that version, which is anachronistic and swiftly paced and has some a sort of spare, speedy style to it. And then subsequent to that, I was approached by the director, Ivo van Hove, to do an Antigone. And when I met with him, he said, I want to do Antigone. I said, great, I've already translated it. He said, yes, I know, I don't like that one. I want a new one. So originally, I was, of course, enraged and said, never. Never would that happen, and went home. And then I thought about it, and it seemed like it would be maybe interesting to just go at it from a whole different place. So I got it out again and started. And that's the second one. Then that's the one that has the name Antigone.
It reminds me of when musicians have to create or end up creating two versions of their same song and maybe a really well-known song. And I just think how hard it must be to get the original song out of their head and create
it's not
something
the original
new.
Song so much, it's the original ego that goes with the song, because you're so pleased when you've made something and then somebody says, yes, well, but there it could be better. And it's hard to believe that at first. But I don't know what it's like for musicians, but for this purpose, it actually, I think, was better. I think the second one is in some ways better. At least it communicates to a wider audience, I think, than the spare, weird one that I did first. The Belgian director, Ivo van Hove, he didn't want it speedy. He wanted it large and substantial, and especially he wanted Creon's function in the story to be of equal weight with Antigone's, so that it wasn't just Antigone's play. And I think that when I went back to it and tried to do that, I found it really interesting to unfold Creon more.
There's a real, I'm not sure if you feel this way too, but when I was reading Antigone, there's a real love for Antigone. I felt from you as the translator. Is that so? I mean, how do you feel about her as a person, as a character?
Yeah, I don't know if I feel a connection to her personally. I think if I did have one, it went into the drawings I did when I first wanted to make a comic book. The drawings. Drawing has, you have a different affection for things that you draw than for things that you write. And the writing, I think in the writing of the both translations, I moved back to a more impersonal level of interaction with her as a character, a name on a page. I didn't have a real sense of her. I wouldn't know whether she's dark or fair. When I did the drawings, they were pencil, they were, you know, sketched black and white, so I didn't have to think about those sort of details. But I do find it hard to become personally attached to characters in translation in a play. Not sure why. I'm just a cold, brutal person, actually.
That must
That's
be it.
Grammar appeals to me.
That must be it.
Kind of lonely, you know, but translation, you have to keep yourself lonely. You can't really, well, you can't become Sophocles. That's an illusion, delusion. That's dangerous to stray into.
So working with a director, is that a collaboration? Is it someone, you know, kind of directing you? I mean, no pun intended.
I don't know. It depends on the person. Ivo van Hove is not that kind of director. He didn't interact a lot with me. He took the text after I'd redone it, and he may have asked a few questions, and then I may have tinkered a bit, but then it was done. And he then went to work on it and invited me to the opening, which was in Luxembourg in February. So by then, he had made all his decisions about how it should look and sound and be. And he was kind of nervous about whether I would like it or not, and greatly relieved when I did. And then he left town, so not a lot of interpersonal interaction there. But other directors work differently, depends on them.
So when you saw it in Luxembourg, what was it like for you to see what you had written being performed? You said you liked it.
Yeah, I was surprised to like it because actually I've attended lots of performances of Greek tragedy in my life, and they're usually pretty awful because people just scream. You know, they start off screaming and then they have nowhere to go except more screaming, and just kind of a horrible experience. But this was restrained and spare in the style of the first play that I did, and I really thought it worked. Emotionally, it worked. And the actors were all just fantastic, which is what makes the words be okay. You know, when they sound right in the voice of the person who has to say them, that's the test of whether it's a good line or not. So it was a shock, kind of, to like it. I didn't expect to like it, but as I say, I think it worked theatrically and emotionally and as language.
In what you read before the interview, I really was intrigued by the line that I actually had you reread. I really was intrigued by "it is a region without law," by the metaphor that you made between what was created and in Antigone and you know, something like Guantanamo Bay. Could you speak a little bit more about that?
Yeah, it's an idea that's explored much more incisively by Judith Butler in various things she's written. And I think it's when I was reading her book on Antigone, it's called Antigone's Claim, that I came to think about this. But the place that Creon invents for Antigone to go to, which he calls a bridal chamber in the ground, is actually the form of a concentration camp, because there's this place where she's supposed to stay alive because he can't officially kill her, and yet he doesn't want to be guilty of her death. So he says he's going to leave her there with just enough food to stay alive and so avoid moral pollution for himself, but be quit of her as a problem. And nobody can nowadays think about that situation without thinking Guantanamo, because those people are still there for years and years, and they're people without a place to be. Not alive and not dead, but otherwise in what Judith Butler calls the permanent elsewhere. So I was very, very struck by that. And there's really nothing to do with it except say it. There it is. There's an image. We're enacting this image again, and still awfully wrong.
Beautifully said. And I think such a great insight, such an important insight. Do you think that might be one of the reasons why this is resonating so much now? I mean, we had a performance here in in the Bay Area of Antigonic, which was really well received. And do you think it's because of those things that are going on currently in within our culture and our world that this play is so, you know, so important right now?
I think that's part of it. Yes, this situation of relegating people to places that aren't places, stateless, as they're called. And there, yes, it's partly that. There's also this other image that I didn't talk about in the introduction. I don't know what to say about it, but the issue of burial itself is something that's a little remote from modern sensibility because we don't have the experience, many of us, of actually burying our dead and being intimately connected to that ritual. But around the time I was translating this, there was a photograph on the New York Times, the front page of, it was during the Ebola crisis, the height of the Ebola crisis, and it was a hospital where an Ebola patient was being, who had died, was being carried across a courtyard by two medical professionals wrapped up in the gear. And kneeling in the middle of the courtyard was a woman who was visibly throwing a handful of dirt on this body as it passed. And it just struck me all of a sudden what the significance of that is for Antigone, or for anybody who has that sort of relation to a dead loved one, that instinct to simply cover the body somehow with a layer of decency, even if it's only a handful of dust. So there is that other aspect of it, I think, that comes into our apprehension of the play, maybe not consciously, but at some level.
I remember going to my first, and I think only, funeral in Jewish culture and or religion, culture and religion. And you have to take a, you know, shovel up some dirt and pour it into the grave. And I remember thinking how hard that was.
Yes, it is hard because it's like saying now they belong to the other place. But if you don't do that, then there's no, for them, there's no passage from this place to that. And that's the problem with her brother. He's stuck in between, like she gets stuck in between. Apparently that doesn't work, to leave people in between.
Apparently not. Apparently not. But I love how strong she is and how determined she is to support him. I mean, it.
Yeah, she's very strong and very, I mean, strong enough to be confusing because I think you never quite know throughout the play what her motive is. You never know why she buries the body twice, for example, which it seems that she does in the beginning. You never know why she insists to her sister that her sister publish the news of her having buried it the second time. She wants that celebrity, maybe, but that seems trivial. She wants something more than just doing it. She wants it known. And then she's always talking about her brother as if she's in love with him a little bit, and that's weird too.
When you started reading your introduction, you know, the first reflections of the player is that it's confusing, that there's so many different mm-hmm. emotions, and then you throw in political implications as well into the play. Not you and Carson throws in, but the play itself has political implications, and
yeah,
and it and so it is actually really, really confusing.
Yeah, I think that's the one thing that Sophocles is a master of, to put issues in problems of motivation into a play with space around them so that they're not finished thinking yet when you hear the words. And that's partly so that you, the audience, can keep thinking into them. And it's also, I think, because the actors need breathing room around the lines to make them be one thing or another. Two actors aren't going to interpret lines the same way or act the character the same way, and he gives the space around it for that difference to happen and to work within the rest of the dramatization. It's something that not many playwrights know how to do.
And how do you translate that kind of space? I mean, I what I thought was so fantastic about Antigonic was that time, which is also space, became a character in and of itself.
Yes, Nick. I think that this goes back to what we were saying about that high wire act, the finding a place to be impersonal, personal towards the characters, so that I don't, any more than Sophocles did, fill in the whole space of the words that a character says, but allow there to be a bit of air around it for nuance or interpretation or something. I think that's part of holding back from me thinking I know exactly what this says, ever.
How about now? Do you, after having translated it, do you, and having lived with it for a while, and having written two interpretations of it, two translations, do you feel like you know it?
No, you know, I think I could go back and do it a third way, different again. That's not because of anything in me. It's because Sophocles has that kind of deepness in what he thinks and what he does with language. There's always more room to go deeper in Sophocles. Not sure why, but so far that's true.
When I was reading Antigonic and I moved through it so fluidly, I thought to myself, and I said this to my husband, I did read it, but I feel like it's the kind of text that you can read just like that, or you can actually sit with every single line, because every single line is so, you know, so rich in and of itself. And I guess that was what I loved about that, was because when learning about Sophocles, I understood that was, you know, that it's very, it can be, you know, there are so many different interpretations, and that there's a depth to it that leaves you always experiencing more.
Yes, I think, well, bless you for saying that about my lines, but it is true of Sophocles' lines for me so far, that you can always go back, open the book anywhere, take a phrase or a line and think into it in a different way than you did before. And it's not just because it's in ancient Greek or something historical like that. It's because of the way the thinking is. Not sure if we know how to do that anymore. I'm really not sure.
You know, any work one writes and translates affects them. And how do you feel that, having gone through this experience of translating and writing both these books based on the same play, has ultimately affected you?
Ultimately, I guess I'd say I feel refreshed, partly because, mostly because of that experience of doing the one play, the Antigonic, feeling so invested in it and proud of it, pleased with it, and then having somebody say, "Nah, I don't like it at all," and doing it, finding a way to do it again. I think it's like turning over a page in myself that I didn't think I could turn. So I kind of like that.
Those were the reflections of poet and writer Anne Carson, speaking about her translation of Antigone, which is being performed at BAM from September 24th through October 4th as part of the 2015 Next Wave Festival. To learn more about the performance, the director, and the actors, please visit www.bam.org. Thank you for listening to Beyond Antigone, a production of the Brooklyn Academy of Music. The theme music for this podcast was composed by Eric Chabich for So Percussions Project, Imaginary City.